great to be back with you on My Mind this week.
In retrospect, I probably would have done things a little differently.
Jaw-dropping revelations about President Trump's son, Donald Jr., his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and his former campaign manager, Paul Manafort. Their meeting with a Russian lawyer last year on how Moscow might be able to help Trump win the election. While much of the country remains transfixed on this latest bombshell, Senate Republicans are still working on a new health care bill that could lead to substantial cutbacks in aid for those addicted to opioids. So we bring you two perspectives on the magnitude of the opioid addiction problem that we face in this country. Then,
I have taken the whole of Washington, monuments, bureaucrats, history and all, and moved it measurably, solidly to the right.
What a play based on Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia can teach us about political divides and the possibility of compromise. First, Dr. Andrew Kolodny, co-director of opioid policy research at the Heller School for Social Policy and Management at Brandeis University. Dr. Kolodny, it's good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
I must say, America has been described as ground zero for this worldwide opioid epidemic. We here in this country haven't really been able to address. Tell us what the situation is.
Well, that's absolutely right. The opioid crisis has been getting worse every year for 20 years, and we really haven't made much headway. I think a big part of the problem is that the issue hasn't been framed properly, and for many years it was misunderstood. Our opioid crisis is not really a drug abuse problem. We don't have an epidemic of people abusing prescription opioids or an epidemic of people abusing heroin. What we're really dealing with is an epidemic of addiction, an epidemic of opioid addiction. Once somebody has become opioid addicted, they're not using pills or heroin because it's fun. Once you're addicted, you're using because you have to keep using to avoid feeling awful. And it is true that some people developed their opioid addiction because they were using opioids for fun. They were taking them recreationally. They did that too much and got hooked. But many people have also developed their opioid addiction, taking opioids exactly as prescribed by doctors. So the correct way to frame the problem, and if framed the right way, it's easier to address it. The correct way to frame it is as an epidemic of opioid addiction. And if you frame it that way, then you'll understand that the reason we're experiencing historically high levels of overdose deaths, the reason we're seeing heroin and fentanyl flood into non-urban areas, the reason we're seeing a soaring increase in infants born opioid-dependent or children winding up in the foster care system or outbreaks of injection-related infectious diseases, you understand that the driver behind all of these health and social problems has been the very large increase in the number of Americans who have become addicted to opioids over the past 20 years.
And the question becomes, how has that addiction begun? Is it primarily with physician prescription, or is it because people are turning to opioids for fun?
That's a great question, and the CDC has actually answered it, and with some pretty nice data where they've shown that it's been the increase in prescribing of opioids that's really fueled this epidemic. They've shown that as the medical community started to prescribe opioid pain medicine much more aggressively beginning in the 1990s, as the prescribing went up rapidly, rates of addiction and overdose deaths went up in parallel with the increase in prescribing. So this really is an epidemic fueled by doctors and dentists writing too many opioid prescriptions.
So how does that begin? Does do too many doctors turn to these opioids first rather than holding back on them because patients come in and say, "Doctor, I can't stand this pain."
Well, you know, opioids are very good medicines for easing suffering at the end of life. And they also play an important role when used to treat pain for a couple of days after major surgery or a serious accident. But unfortunately, the bulk of the prescribing in the United States is not for end-of-life care or a couple of days after major surgery. The bulk of the prescribing is for common conditions and often common chronic conditions where use of an opioid is not safe or even effective if you're taking an opioid on a daily basis for months and years. In order to continue getting pain relief from an opioid, you have to keep going higher and higher on the dose. And as the dose goes up, you'll see that function begins to decline. And there's also a phenomenon that we're understanding more about recently called hyperalgesia, which means that the opioids can even make pain worse. Huh. So doctors are overprescribing these medications because they are not doing a very good job of weighing the risks versus the benefits for an individual patient in front of them.
I want to go back to something you said, which is that in some cases, the drug could even make the pain for which it might have been prescribed initially even worse. I'm thinking about an older person who might be experiencing pain, whose doctor has prescribed an opioid, and that older person wants to keep the pain at bay, so keeps taking that opioid. What would the opioid addiction look like in that older person? How might it change his or her behavior? What would the outcome look like?
I'm glad that you're asking about older people, because the opioid addiction epidemic has been getting attention in the past couple of years. It's not a new problem, but it's finally getting some attention. Much of the media attention has been focused on younger people who are opioid addicted, people in their 20s and 30s who have been switching to heroin after they become addicted. And in this younger group, they're developing their opioid addiction to prescription opioids that are taken either medically or recreationally, or sometimes it's a combination. A young person with a brief medical exposure who doesn't become addicted from that use for wisdom teeth or sports injury, but that they're no longer afraid of the drug. They basically get their first taste of it from a doctor or a dentist, and that's followed by recreational use, and then they get hooked. The younger group, when they get addicted, doctors don't like to give a large quantity of pills to healthy-looking 25-year-olds on a monthly basis. So that younger group has been switching to heroin. And what we've seen happen in the past few years is in that younger heroin-using group, the death rate has started to soar because the heroin supply is more dangerous now. It has another drug mixed into it called fentanyl, which is many times more potent. But there's this older group of Americans that have also become opioid addicted, people in their 40s up through their 80s. The older group is developing their opioid addiction almost entirely through medical treatment. When they get addicted, they don't generally have a hard time finding doctors who will continue to prescribe them a large quantity on a monthly basis. And even if that older person starts coming into the doctor's office early, and saying, you know, I ran out early, or I need higher and higher doses. Even if the primary care doctor or the geriatrician begins to get concerned that the patient's having trouble controlling their use, the patient will typically attribute the aberrant drug-taking behavior to being related to a worsening of their pain. And because the doctor doesn't want to put a label like addiction on the patient, if the patient gets referred anywhere, it's often to a pain management doctor. And there are some good pain management doctors out there, but there are also many who will have no qualms about going higher and higher on the dose. And something that many people don't realize is that for the past 10, 15 years, we've actually seen far more deaths in the older group that gets pills more easily from doctors than we've been seeing in the younger group that's been switching to heroin. The younger group is now catching up because of fentanyl, but we've still seen many more deaths over the past 10, 15 years in the older group.
What if someone decides to go off one of these opioids cold turkey? What happens?
It's very difficult for people to come off. When someone is going into withdrawal from opioids, and you don't, you know, this happens to just about everybody who takes an opioid, even for as little as 5 days, you'll feel symptoms when you stop it abruptly. If you were on opioids for longer, you know, for months, especially if you were on a high dose, people will feel very sick. And the symptoms that are experienced have been described as flu-like. So people feel acutely physically ill when they're going into withdrawal. But actually, the worst of it isn't the physical symptoms. It's very severe anxiety that sets in when people are going into withdrawal. It's very similar to a panic attack. The region of the brain that controls our fight or flight response, the region of the brain that would pump out adrenaline if you were in the jungle and there was a lion ready to tear you apart and you need to run for your life, that the region of the brain is called the locus coeruleus. And when people take opioids chronically, it inhibits that region of the brain. It basically puts that region of the brain to sleep, and it's one of the reasons why opioids can even reduce anxiety when you take them. But when you go into withdrawal, that region of the brain wakes up, and it starts firing like crazy. So people feel as if there's, you know, a lion in the jungle ready to tear them apart, but they don't see it. It's been described as a sense of impending doom. Uh-huh. So if you ever wonder why people will do such desperate things to maintain their opioid supply, even injure themselves on purpose so they could go to an emergency room to get an opioid, it isn't that they're afraid to feel like they have the flu. It's because there's this feeling like you're going to die when you're going to run out of opioids. And anyone who's ever experienced that, they've been on opioids and they've gone through that, or even just they've started to go through that. Once you've experienced that, your life will begin to revolve around making sure you never run out of opioids again.
One last question, Dr. Kolodny. To what extent do you believe the government will have to get involved, and how, to reduce or reverse this trend of addiction we're seeing?
So to bring our opioid addiction epidemic under control and to ultimately bring it to an end, there are really two things that have to be accomplished. I went out of my way to really frame the issue as an addiction epidemic, because if you frame it properly, you know, the strategies for bringing it under control become more clear. What we have to do for our opioid addiction epidemic is is very similar to what we would do for other disease epidemics, even infectious disease outbreaks. The way you would respond to an infectious disease outbreak, let's say in the Ebola epidemic, what you would do is, there are really two things. The first thing you would do is contain it so that more people don't get that infection. So the first thing you do is prevent new cases of the disease. And the second thing you do is make sure that everybody who has the disease is getting effective treatment for it so they don't die from it. And that's basically what we have to do for our opioid addiction epidemic. We have to prevent more Americans from becoming opioid addicted. And to achieve that, more than anything else, it really boils down to much more cautious prescribing so that we don't directly addict our patients and so that we don't indirectly cause addiction by stocking everybody's home with a highly addictive drug. And then, of course, for the millions that are already addicted, we have to see that they can access effective treatment. And by effective treatment for opioid addiction, it's not really going for detox or spending 28 days in a rehab that we need. That doesn't help most people who are opioid addicted. Most people who are opioid addicted are going to need very long-term outpatient treatment with a medicine like buprenorphine to maintain them and which will control their cravings and allow them to function. And we are failing really on both fronts in our opioid addiction epidemic. The CDC released a report last week which showed that prescribing has come down a bit, but that we are still three times higher than where we were in 1999. And in 1999, we were already too high. That was already into the increase. And so we're failing to really prescribe more cautiously. And we're also failing to see that people who are addicted can access the most effective treatments. There is inadequate access to treatment with buprenorphine. So there's a really important role for both the federal government and state governments on both fronts. And up until pretty recently, certainly the federal government had really focused on the wrong issue. They had bought into this notion that the crisis was all about drug abusers. And if you look at what was coming out of the federal government, with the exception of the CDC, which has had a good understanding of the problem for many years, everything the federal government was focusing on was stopping kids from getting into grandma's medicine chest. Mm-hmm. They were focused on what was termed non-medical use. But no, they weren't really asking, why does every grandma now have opioids in her medicine chest?
Yeah. Dr. Kolodny, this has been just fascinating, and I'm sure your comments are going to inform a great many people, and among them, I hope, many doctors who may be over-prescribing opioids. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Diane.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
On the front lines of helping those suffering from addiction, Stephanie Bergeron. She is the executive director of Serenity Place in Manchester, New Hampshire.
Hi, nice to meet you.
It's good to meet you. Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, you're very welcome.
I know the opioid crisis is hitting hard all across the country, but especially in New Hampshire. The drug cartel seemed to have found a great opportunity. Tell us what's going on.
The cartel specifically targeted New England regions and definitely New Hampshire, knowing that there were a high rate of opioid prescriptions, people becoming addicted to these medications. And as part of this substance use disorder, people seeking pills or seeking their prescriptions, once their prescriptions had run out, continuing to seeking these medications, but they're somewhat expensive on the street without a prescription, and the cartels recognizing that this is a prime opportunity. They basically had a business plan to kind of come into these communities and introduce heroin at a much lower rate. It was easier for people to obtain heroin instead of taking these prescription medications. And that's kind of a very brief snapshot of kind of how we got to where we are today.
Is the opioid epidemic presenting itself in overwhelming terms as opposed to, say, alcohol? Are you seeing more and more individuals with opioid addiction, say, than 2 years ago?
We definitely are, but alcohol has always been on the forefront and it hasn't gone away. But definitely, if we're comparing the past 2 years, it definitely has increased. And unfortunately, a lot of the other substances in the community haven't gone away. So we have an interesting, unfortunate dilemma now where there's so many substances available on the street, where dealers even give them away for free, that someone may not be seeking heroin or fentanyl because for whatever reason, but crack and crystal meth are still out there. So the episodes of poly use that we see where individuals are using a number of substances or they don't even really know what they're using because of what they got on the street could be cut with something else that we don't even know about yet, or we do know, but we don't know the ratio. So there's a lot of risk, but we've definitely seen an uptick in the past 2 years.
I wonder what the underlying causes were that made New Hampshire quite so vulnerable. I realize that there were numerous prescriptions written, but there must have been some underlying causes as well.
I think there probably were. We weren't prepared for something of this magnitude to infiltrate our community like this. But also maybe the education piece about whether it's pain management or prescriptions in general, or even, you know, I work closely with a lot of physicians in the community, and they openly admit to not having enough education around substance misuse and substance use disorders. And I don't know if that's unique to New Hampshire or if that is an issue, nationwide across the United States. But, when 80% of the world's opioids are prescribed in the United States, I would say that's probably an issue. But I'm not sure if there was one underlying issue that would have pinpointed this.
I wonder, Stephanie, about the kinds of resources, the kinds of help that you are involved in offering.
As an agency in, in the largest community, we're the largest city in New Hampshire, we've always been kind of conditioned to help the whole state because we have the most resources. And when we're on the forefront of which most of us consider a public health crisis, we have to react in a very mindful, appropriate way, but sometimes that means we have to act quickly, and we're kind of functioning in crisis mode. So we do offer residential treatment services. We have outpatient services. But on the outpatient end, we knew that's where we were probably going to have the most opportunity to react to this appropriately. So we implemented a program, a wraparound services program, which was kind of conceptualized to remove all the barriers that people experience often when they're looking for treatment, whether it's for a substance use disorder or a mental health issue. It's often hard for people to navigate their insurances or even figure out what they need. And even if they have a primary care physician they can talk to about this, the system hasn't always been easy to navigate. So our goal was to make sure that individuals or families or anyone could get to us on a walk-in basis and just sit down with a case manager, sit down with a clinician, and we start the process.
I must say it would seem that there may be a whole generation of people affected by this addiction crisis. And I wonder not only what that might mean for New Hampshire, but for the country as a whole, which is indeed experiencing the same kind of opioid addiction as you in New Hampshire.
Yes, that is true. That there, it is affecting a whole generation, and this is definitely happening nationwide. I am fortunate to have colleagues that I can reach out to across the country, and I think what we're seeing is not only a significant portion of this particular generation who have not survived this opioid epidemic and have died because of an overdose. We have a generation of individuals who are going to be in long-term recovery. Some of them may have felony possession charges. So them entering the workforce, that presents a challenge. At the same time, we have grandparents who have taken on custody of their grandchildren, which is probably something they never thought they would have to do, a lot of children in the foster care system. And, you know, even on the business end of this, if you think about workforce development issues, this is happening right around us in Manchester and in the rest of New Hampshire, where there are jobs in the community where the age group, you know, 19 to 30, individuals who kind of worked through different jobs or with different career paths, they're not filling those positions in the construction fields or auto mechanics, where some of the trades in the community where, you know, people kind of start out, there's individuals who would normally fill those jobs. We don't have a generation ready to fill those jobs, so it's impacting workforce, it's impacting businesses. There's a lot happening around this.
Stephanie Bergeron, she is executive director of Serenity Place, a treatment facility in Manchester, New Hampshire. Stephanie, thank you so much for being with us.
You're very welcome. It was my pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Now a quick break. And we're back. The play, The Originalist, is about the late Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. It challenges us to think about our political discourse. The play premiered in Washington, D.C. in 2015. Now it's back in a totally different political environment. I talked with playwright John Strand, writer of The Originalist, and Edward Giro, the award-winning actor who plays Scalia. John, this play was originally performed here in Washington at Arena Stage in 2015. Now you are bringing it back to Washington at a time of real political turmoil in this city. Does the play, in your mind, represent in some ways what's happening here?
Oh, I think clearly it does. I mean, I think that the reason I wrote the play was not that I felt we needed a stage biography of Antonin Scalia, however interesting or terrifying he might be based on where you stand politically, but really because he gave me the opportunity, being a sort of really kind of a polarizing figure, to explore what happened to compromise, what happened to the political middle. How could we get back there? If I put on stage two people who were diametrically opposed ideologically, politically, is there a way for them to talk to one another without first demonizing one another? It was, and I think when I wrote the play in 2015, I felt that the, you know, the abandoned middle was really a kind of scandalous in American politics. It is only worse now, so I can't say that the play itself seems to have healed those wounds. But it does make people aware, I think, and it gives people an opportunity to think about how our own closed-mindedness, which we all have.
Let's hear a clip from the play, Edward. This is a piece where representing exactly what you've been talking about, John.
Just how liberal are you, anyway?
Sir, I fall into the flaming category.
Flaming? Probably every liberal's fate in the afterlife.
Eternal hellfire?
God's punishment for stubbornly refusing to see things the way they are.
Better than bullying people to see things as you dictate them to be.
Well, morally better, maybe. Practically speaking, it's passive and defeatist. In a word, liberal.
I can't tell if you're joking.
Yes, I know.
Edward Giro, he spoke in such declarative, strong sentences.
He did.
And yet that young woman, that clerk, listened to what he said and spoke back to him.
True, true. That's what civil discourse is about. It's predicated on the fact that the other person has quality. So, like in Shakespeare, you can presume that the person is speaking from their higher self, or at least you come to the conversation that way, rather than you're different than me, I don't agree with you, therefore you're less of a human being. That's not civil discourse. There's no discourse whatsoever without communicating a sense of quality in the other person, and that's what the play models, and that's certainly what the court models. It's the great Socratic classroom, really.
It's a fascinating idea to base a play on the importance of listening, John.
Quite so, right? I thought that when I first began to research Scalia and the attitudes toward him, I was shocked in the blogosphere by the kind of animosity, the towering hatred that's expressed for the guy. And the thing that really disturbed me is that people would go on at length about his rulings, and it was clear they had never bothered to read the actual ruling or his dissent, etc., but they attacked him because he had a target on his back because of his ideology and his politics. I thought, if we take Antonin Scalia, put him on stage, let him use some of the words that are in his own writing, in his own dissent, there we are, gathered together in the dark as a group, and we're listening. Now we can decide if we disagree, why we disagree, and maybe even formulate an intelligence response, not a, I can't stand you because you represent my opposite viewpoints. I mean, that goes nowhere. That's childish. So it gives us an opportunity to do that on stage and in the hands of a great actor. It's very powerful.
To just dovetail on what John was saying, the first moment of the play, we see Scalia enter listening.
Exquisite! My God, that is so good. I love opera. The most complete and demanding art form. Now, of course, the audience for it is disappearing, but what do you expect?
And that's where the play starts. Effort, that really is the core. And we've forgotten how to do that, I think.
I must say, I have to forgive my dissent here, but it does seem to me that on occasion in his dissent written on and spoken at the court, he did sometimes put down the other side as saying this decision is absolutely ridiculous, it makes no sense, I cannot understand why anyone would vote for it. I mean, he was a listener, but he was also a putter-downer.
He was a fighter. He mm-hmm. was, you know, he had a punch, and he was going to deliver it then. And I think that's part of his style. And in his dissents, there are many instances where you're shocked reading them because he punches hard with people, to people with whom he disagrees. Now, on the other hand, we know that he had very cordial relationships with the justices after the dissent was
indeed,
over.
Indeed.
And that's a model that we've talked a lot about that during the course of the play, how when the argument is presented and then the gloves come off, and if you really believe in something, a point, then you'll fight for it.
The play really centers around the relationship between Scalia and his very liberal law clerk. Let's hear a clip.
He can go right here. Few public controversies inspire such attendant passion by good people on all sides.
You expect to add lines to his dissent?
A dozen words, that's all I'm asking.
Out of the question! Out of the question!
You spin this whole dissent pummeling the other justices into a bloody pulp.
Which they deserve.
Bend a little for God's
sake. We are dealing with a matter of law, plain and simple.
It's not about law, it's about the human heart. Here, look, you're closing. Some will rejoice in today's decision, and some will despair at it.
So they will.
But acknowledge how much is at stake. And some will despair at it. That is the nature of a controversy that matters so much to so many. Just add that one line.
No.
It doesn't change the argument.
Then why add it? I've got to go, Pat.
We're still negotiating.
I don't negotiate, no.
He enjoys the person who disagrees with him because he can argue and he could get into the nuts and bolts of language and tear it apart and break it down and be clear and precise. And that comes as a shock to her because it takes her out of her preconceived notions about who he is and vice versa. But it eventually is a warm relationship. Without changing political views, by the way, and that's the great shot that John really has his finger on.
Exactly, and she is a young African American woman.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, she is, and in that sense, very alone, probably among the clerks of that particular year. But she does not back down. I think her greatest struggle is to open her own mind a little bit. I think she comes into the relationship thinking, how can I get this man to open his mind a little bit and see my viewpoint? But I think what she discovers is perhaps my mind is just as closed. I need to do something to open that as well. And when those two things can happen, then at least we're presented with a possibility. Now I can talk to you. You can hear what I'm saying. Maybe even I take one step toward you, maybe two steps toward you, but it's a process and it requires a kind of trust and respect. And I think that we've lost a lot of the trust and respect.
I mean, you have to be vulnerable to listen, don't you?
You do.
You have to open your heart,
absolutely,
open your mind, and that's a scary landscape to walk on.
Tell me how audiences have reacted.
It's been really gratifying to see the kind of engagement. When I'm at a show, I always watch the audience. I always kind of...
Because you know what's happening on the play.
Yeah, so I have a pretty good idea what's coming. But I really want to see what's the level of engagement in the audience. What's the commitment? And you can tell instantly the posturing, the position, the whispering, the response to the lines, whether it's a laugh or whether it's a groan. And even sometimes there are audience members who shout out their protest over a particular point.
Oh, yeah. Oh, they do.
You know, so you,
they're very verbal.
And we've talked throughout. This is the fourth production of the play now at this reprise at Arena. And we've talked to hundreds of people who either because we approached them or they've approached us to tell us what they really felt about the play. And people have been very, very moved.
Yeah. And relieved. Mm. Really relieved.
Actually, we had some comments from Facebook. It's a comment from Marcella. She says, good play, nicer to Scalia than his memory deserves.
Oh, that's unfair.
I had more than once someone's come up to me afterwards and said, you know, I love the play. And I still hate the beep.
Yeah.
I still hate him. The attempt in the play is not to, polish up his image and present him as someone he's not. But I think the attempt is to look at the humanity and the depth behind him, not the political position.
I said to the justice at one point, I said, you know, I've done a lot of characters from Shakespeare that audiences love to hate, but this is the first time I've done a character that audiences hate to love. But by the end of the play, they move, you can feel the move off that position about him as a human being, aside from the political point of view. But they get a sense of his humanity, his sense, his spirituality. One of the dialectics in the play is Kat is searching for his heart, and he is searching for her soul. She's a lapsed Catholic. They have that in common, and that becomes one of the cruxes of the play where they meet together on the spiritual life, and that's different from the law. And he even says in the play that the soul is more important than anything in law or politics.
Of course, you sat down and had several lunches with him, did you?
I did indeed.
And what was that like?
It was remarkable, life-altering. Probably
how
the
so?
Well, he's the most intelligent man that I ever met in my life. To be in the room, in the court, to watch government work, to see how collegial the body is, to see the model that, thank goodness that the founders decided to create a branch of government that was an intellectual branch.
I think we should point out that Justice Scalia never attended a performance. Were you disappointed by that?
A bit. The first thing he said, he wasn't coming to see it.
So
he said right away, from the top.
But why?
I invited him to a closed rehearsal. Maybe it was didn't want to come out in public. And,
right.
And actually, when Justice Ginsburg came to see the show the first time, and her name is mentioned, people were standing up and looking to see what her reaction was. So perhaps it was a generous thing on his part to say it's not about me; it's about the play. But I did invite him. And at first he said, okay. And then 2 days later, he demurred. Huh. And he sent me a little note. And he said, if I go see it, and people will know, they'll ask me what I thought. If I said that I liked it, he said, and I'm sure there'll be things in it I will find unfair, they'll think that I'm endorsing the whole project. If I say I didn't like it, I'll be accused of being thin-skinned. So sorry to disappoint.
You must have been disappointed, John.
I wish he had come. I think it would have been memorable, to say the least. And I think that there are certainly things that he would have objected to in the play. But we won't know now, and I regret that he didn't come.
And, of course, during the time the play began, and now when it comes back, we've lost Justice Scalia. How has that changed you in your portrayal?
I think just the passing of time, the experience of losing him has deepened my connection on an aesthetic level or on a personal level. I feel in some ways responsible to be as clear and fair and about who he was, to honor who he was and to honor what he did, because he had an enormous impact on how we understand the law. And I think, you know, everyone from Justice Kagan to everyone on the bench would concur that he had a profound impact on how we think about the law, not what, but how. And I feel a little sense of mission about that. Particularly with the state of the political landscape at the moment. It's important. And it's important particularly to be in Washington as an artist, to have the opportunity to be a bit of a citizen artist and to participate in the conversation about our democracy.
I love the fact that the play has been extended for another week. Public demand is out there. Finally, I'd be interested in how this play may or may not have changed you as an actor, you as a writer.
Well, I think as a writer, I'm very gratified by the response and the interest on the part of people who have come to see the play. I mean, I feel that there was a kind of hunger to listen to the arguments, to think about it. And when you leave the theater, you're still thinking about it, debating, talking about it. There isn't one answer. It wasn't, of course, that's insulting to the audience that I'm going to present an argument and give you the answer to it. Of course, you don't ever wish to do that. That's a lecture, not a play. So, but I've noticed that people have told us, all of us connected with the play, that the memory of what happened that night on stage, and there's a kind of optimism. I always have felt that the play is actually very hopeful
in
many ways, that it shows that there's a way to listen. And all of the things are very important if the topic is really worth concentrating on and listening to. And these are issues of phenomenal importance to us. You know, a justice gets to sit at the crossroads of all of these crucial interpretations and reinterpretations of democracy, who we are as a society and as a nation. That's important.
And Edward, do you think that doing this play night after night after night has in any way changed the manner in which you listen and hear?
I think so. I listen more acutely to the audience every night. They're the real guests of the evening, and taking their temperature, whether, for example, I went to the Obergefell hearing and had lunch with the justice that afternoon, and we were doing the play that night. So any conversation about Doma on that particular night was, you could hear a pin drop, because maybe there's a sense of what's going to happen with this decision. Now it's different. There's a line in the play that was never noticed before in that conversation we were talking about where he's revealing his sort of sensitivity, and he says, "We are still the most successful democracy on earth." Two nights ago, you could hear people say, that wasn't there before.
No.
So the listening to the audience has become more acute.
The lines land differently now that he has passed. One of the more obvious examples is that his clerk accuses him of being the most polarizing figure in American society. And during the play in Pasadena, I could audibly hear an audience member say, "Not anymore."
So. And we'll leave it at that. Edward Jerrell, John Strand, congratulations to both of you, and thank you for being here.
Thank you. Great
thank
pleasure.
And now, from the archives, more on Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. In 2009, I spoke with Supreme Court reporter Joan Biskupic about her biography of Scalia.
Congratulations on this book. I know you've been working on it for a long time.
Thank you. The very first sit-down interview I had with this man was in 1990 when I was new in town as a reporter. And I've been watching him for many years, but I really started in earnest about 4 years ago after the Sandra Day O'Connor book. And it's been quite a trip. It was more challenging than the Sandra Day O'Connor book in some ways, because he's so darn polarizing, as you say, and a lot of tension and conflict around him. He doesn't have a linear story the way my prior subject did, but it's been it was both challenging and, I have to say, in the end, more rewarding, actually.
Interesting.
You can listen to that entire segment at dianereem.org. That's our show for this week. We'd love to hear what's on your mind. Send us an email at drpodcast@wamu.org. Leave us a voicemail. The number is 202-854-8851, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden, comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show is produced by Sandra Baker and Rebecca Kaufman. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.